Hello, Bill.
Welcome back, Con.
It's good to be back, Bill.
For folks who don't know, who maybe have just been DMZ fans with Matt and myself, Matt is still taking a break. The original left-right blogging ads duo was Con Carroll and myself back when it was The Week in Blog. We rechristened as
this was pre-2008.
Yes. This was when you were a journalist. When you were at the National Journal, not working for conservative outfits.
Did we start all the way back when I was at the National Journal? I thought we started when I was at Heritage.
No, before you, we did stuff before Heritage.
But was it TWID before Heritage?
I guess we did a few things before we gave ourselves a name.
Okay.
But I thought you'd switch to Heritage. I'll look at the videotape.
Because I was per Hotline, I was playing a straight journalist
while
I was there.
And you deserved an Oscar for that.
I fooled a lot of people.
But as you may or may not know, you know, we do the DMZ with Matt as like a we're nice to each other. We're congenial. We try to argue too much. That's not quite your bent. So
we were never nice to each other.
We're friends. We like each other. But you know, I think your approach is a little different than Matt. That's all I'm saying. It's a little different.
Okay, fair enough.
I might suspend some of the DMZ rules for this edition.
Well, I'll try to behave.
Now, as you reminded me, as I did not recall, you were the first person to interview Nate Silver on Blogging Heads. This is even before he was doing 530, doing politics. He was mostly doing sports stats, right?
Yes. He was at Baseball Prospectus at the time.
So you have a long-standing relationship with him. He's now launched 538.com writ large as an ABC, ESPN, Disney operation with a big staff and a big mission to kind of blaze the trail of data-driven journalism. And he's gotten a lot of guff from a number of corners, but I think most prominently Paul Krugman, who's had a series of posts saying this just isn't good data-driven journalism. And Nate has returned fire, calling Paul Krugman a pundit, which is generally considered an insult in Nate's view of things. People who are knee-jerk and don't follow data, and has a post about 538 essentially chronicling how Paul Krugman said nice things about 538 when he was with the New York Times and now is not saying nice things now that he's not with the New York Times. What's your take on all this? Do you feel that Nate has not lived up to the promise and Paul Krugman has a point? Or is Paul Krugman just taking a shot at Nate because he left the Times and also because Nate said last week the Republicans have the edge on winning back the Senate and Krugman's a liberal and he's unhappy about that? What do you think is going on here?
I think this is pure in-group, out-group, disciplining. Paul Krugman's a total leftist hack. He has no intellectual integrity at all. And so I knew when I read Nate Silver's book a year ago when it came out that there was going to be a falling out between him and the left. His chapter on global warming was far too balanced and data-driven to pass for, you know, Joe Rahm, rabid, fathing at the mouth activism. And so but even before the new site launched, 538 launched for ESPN, there was an announcement that Nate Silver had hired Roger Pilkey Jr., who is a scientist at Colorado.
He's a political scientist and not a climate scientist.
When that went out, I knew that Nate was going to get excommunicated from the progressive movement post-haste. And this is well before, again, the launch. And then, so even before the launch, Krugman then had a post that I saw as a high fastball, you know, kind of at Nate's chin, warning him not to leave the reservation, not to, you know, start bad mouthing or doubting Democratic talking points. And it's specifically linked to a Joe Rahm post slamming Nate for his climate chapter in his book. So then, of course, Nate's site launched, and it wasn't, you know, purely Democratic talking points, unlike Ezra Klein's effort, which is going to be a purely, you know, DNC press release done up with nice, pretty videos site. So it's not going to be just, you know, liberals talking to liberals about how awesome liberals are. It's going to actually try to talk to a broader audience and inform people. So Krugman can have this. And so ever since then, it's just been all-out war by Krugman on Nate. And I think Nate's handled it very well. He's handled it, you know, with aplomb and with humor. And Krugman's clearly, you know, losing it and looking as bat crazy as he ever is.
I disagree.
No, really. Go on.
I don't think this is necessarily just a left-right or a left-center dispute. I mean, I don't think there's a lot of folks on the left who are incredulous that Nate says Republicans have a 60% edge in winning back the Senate. That's not a crazy thing to say.
Well, the DSCC sure is.
Well, but that's their job. It's their job to say, no, we can win back the Senate. And of course, Nate's saying you have a 40% chance winning back the Senate. He's not saying they have a 0% chance. But I don't think people outside of people in the party machinery are that concerned about stuff like that. I think there is a bigger concern about Pilkey. I mean, and there was a big concern amongst climate scientists with that chapter in the book, not because it was too balanced, but because it did not follow climate science. I mean, the most recent thing that happened was that Krugman linked to a no opinion post criticizing the new 538. And one example it gives is one of the Pilkey climate posts. This is what Noah said. Roger Pilkey notes that natural disaster losses have slightly decreased since 1989 as a percentage of world GDP, and concludes that climate change is not causing and will never cause increased losses. This post has been much maligned by professional climate scientists for having crappy and misleading data. But put that aside for now. Let's focus on the idea that this post represents data-driven journalism at all. It doesn't. The data in the post consists of one annual time series with a sample size of 23. That's too small to do any sort of statistical analysis on, but then again, the post doesn't do any statistical analysis. It shows a trend line, and from that trend line, it draws broad, sweeping conclusions about the effects of climate change. How is that more data-driven than what any blog does? Furthermore, Pilkey's analysis is just sloppy. What happens when you strip out earthquakes, tsunamis, volcanoes, etc. from the data? What if you extend the trend back 40 years instead of just 23? How does the recent trend compare with the trend from before climate change started significantly affecting global temperatures? And so on. So, you know, that's the stuff that Krugman is highlighting here. He's not complaining about his predictions or probabilities about the Senate. And what does Nate do in response? The most recent thing Nate did was to do this infographic showing how Krugman's assessment of Nate shifted since Nate left, to suggest that it's just because he left the New York Times and therefore he's mad about that, as if Krugman is a big New York Times cheerleader, that he always loves David Brooks' posts and Thomas Friedman's posts because they're on the same team. I mean, it's a classic example of cherry-picking data points and ignoring larger context. Nate is doing a different thing completely, with a bigger staff and bigger mission and bigger standards, of his self-grade standards, than what he was doing before. And Krugman is arguing that he's not living up to those standards. And that's not really addressed in Nate's own post. It confirms the whole point that just saying you're doing data and showing some morsel of data in your post does not mean you're doing quality data-driven journalism. That seems to be the point. And I think Nate is making Krugman's case inadvertently.
Yeah, I mean, I think the other thing to draw from Krugman's post is, you know, he links to this other liberal site that's supposedly tracking Obamacare sign-up data in a objective way. But when you go to the site, it's clearly, you know, an Obama fanboy who is, you know, cheerleading for Obamacare at every stretch. And, you know, if you look at it, you know, there's no way to compare the data to past results, you know, which was always kind of, you know, Nate's thing about polls. There was a long history you could go back and look at to see, you know, how reliable polling data in the past. You know, same with his baseball past, right? I mean, that's one of the beauties of football. I mean, not football, baseball over football or basketball is you have a long history of data to look at that makes, you know, AAA data now applicable to the future. So you can try to model off of it. So I think Nate has shown a great ability to know the limits of data and what it can and cannot accomplish. When I read his book, I was very pleased with, you know, how he, made a note that data was a tool. And I think what Nate Silver's site was before was, basically a place for liberals to go to feel safe and comforted that they were going to win. And they didn't really care about the accuracy of the data or the science behind it or any of that. They never do. They were just using it as an emotional crutch to help them get them through the difficult race. And now that Nate has not is done serving that purpose and is moving on to other things, they don't have any need for him. He's not part of their tribe. And since he's not part of the tribe, he's now being attacked.
Well, I think you're
and that's all that's going on. Everything else is just smoke.
I think you're conflating a couple of things here. I mean, I'm going to go to your first point about Nate understands the limits of data. And I'd say that is generally true. One of the things why I felt Nate has been kind of overhyped is that often when you dig down to a post, you know, he's not saying he's predicting things, he's giving you probabilities. And of course, any probability has, even if it's a 90% chance, there's some 10% chance that the main probability is not going to come out right. And he'll say that. He'll have the hedge, which is fine. But at the same time, he'll then overstate the certainty of it all in other contexts. That just by saying, like, this data journalism that I'm doing is inherently superior to knee-jerk punditry, you know, gives a false sense of certainty. And so he doesn't always square that. I do agree that if you dig down deep enough in the post, you will get there. But it does limit its value. I think it is a nice, it's good to see more of it. It's nice to see it complement older style journalism. I do think you see some limitations of it when you're doing this massive site with a big staff and you're trying to slice and dice all sorts of things multiple times every day. You know, a lot of it's going to end up being very superficial, whether in what it's trying to divine and how it's actually executed. So I think he's having some early struggles with that. He very well can improve over time. Many early launches have lots of bugs, either literal or figurative, and they get ironed out. So I think he's a bright guy. I wouldn't count him out. I don't think he is damaged goods, but he might be in better shape if he takes some of this constructive criticism seriously and not just fires back in a juvenile way. But to your other point that the left has no interest in him just because he's not part of the tribe now, I don't think he was ever part of the tribe. I don't think anyone thought of him as part of the tribe. I agree that he had massive traffic for the New York Times for a brief window at the end of 2012 because it was reaffirming. I think there was a psychological reason for that that did not get into the science of it. And I think because of that, his stock was overvalued. You know, there's always talk that, well, he was bringing in, you know, half of New York Times traffic at that point. Well, yeah, because we were just clicking it over and over again to reaffirm what they wanted to know. It doesn't mean it's going to be like that in the off season all the time. There was a certain, you know, lightning in a bottle moment there. But I think there's definitely a Nate Silver fan club that had leaned left, and maybe won't lean left now, but had leaned left because of a general appreciation for data. I think there is a technocratic element to the left, a scientific element to the left, which the right does has in some degree, but I don't think as much lately. And I don't think that goes away. I'm sure there are some people on the left who are still on Team Nate here and still want to see this kind of journalism work and think he's a good guy to do it. So I think you're oversimplifying by saying the entire left is washing its hands of them, although I do think particularly the Roger Pilkey hire definitely sticks in the craw of certainly the environmental left.
Bill, we're back.
Small title hiccup, but nothing lost. But shifting topic.
Hold on. Before we shift topics.
Sure.
You have to let me talk about the whole reason I came on today.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry that I didn't do that up front.
You totally steamrolled me.
I was just so excited to talk to you.
You were. But anyways, I am here to hawk. Well, not really hawk because I haven't created it yet. But I'm here to plead with the Blogging Heads community, who I know as a entrepreneurial base, to please consider supporting my Kickstarter. It's called Federal Baseball. Speaking of Nate Silver in baseball, it is going to be an iPhone app that allows you to take over any baseball team in any year and basically be the general manager and manage them to multiple World Series titles, be able to draft players, trade them, sign free agents, and basically, you know, relive your childhood, but in the owner's box. So how
is this different than fantasy baseball, or is it just another way to
That's
do
a great
baseball?
Question, Bill. I'm glad you're interested in this topic. So for fantasy baseball, you know, you just go and you draft real live players onto a team, and then the results for your league are determined by what the players are doing in real life that year. What this allows you to do is go back to, let's say, 1987, take over the San Francisco Giants and actually play other real teams. You can play, well, you just play the Giants season. So you play the Dodgers and Padres. In each of the games, the results would be determined by what those players' stats were for that year. And then you'd be able to go on to 1988, resign the people you want to resign, trade the people you don't want to trade, and go through that season as well, which is very different from fantasy baseball, in which, you know, you're repicking a group of players, but only this year's players right now.
Now, as I've discussed with Matt in the past, you know, I'm kind of your average pajama boy. I've walked away from sports except for Aussie Rules football. I think part of it was I never got my head around enjoying sports in the fantasy baseball way, as opposed to just being a cheerleader for your team. As a kid, that's what I did. I cheerleaded for my team. I mean, I was interested in stats. I was interested in baseball history, all that stuff. But as far as when the season was on, I wasn't as interested in sort of picking and choosing different players and seeing the different, having my own kind of all-star team and watching them go and cheering individual players for their individual performances and not for the team. I just never got my head around that. Explain to me your enjoyment of sports in this way, because I've never really grasped it.
Sure. Well, you know, I think it's on two ways. You know, number one, you know, right now I think a lot of baseball, in particular, as far as sport court, is you know, nostalgia. Like for me, when I take my son to a game, I'm not just going to the game with my son. I'm going to the game with my dad, his dad, etc. It's a generational thing, and a game like this allow you to take that back. You know, with this game, you can go back and replay the 1907 playoffs, which I went to with my dad, who passed away, you know, almost 20 years ago now. So it's kind of a way to connect with them and the timelessness of it. But as far as being wanted to the enjoyment of fantasy baseball in general, you know, it's strategy like anything else. You're trying to outsmart the other owners. You're trying to see, you know, which players are going to do better, how to allocate your payroll and your resources. It's like any other game. You have a set number of resources. You have to develop a strategy and see how you do.
Fair enough. So how can people get to your Kickstarter?
Oh, just Kickstarter, Google Kickstarter, Federal Baseball, and that'll get you there. But of course, I will have a link to the Kickstarter right under this video. I'll be the first commenter to get it up there, have it on the sidebar, whatever. I may come back to the comment area a couple times to repost the Kickstarter link, So it'll be there often.
Awesome. Now, another thing you were interested in was this Thomas Edsel post for the New York Times website. And Edsel, for a while, was, I think, pushing kind of a centrist line. And I feel he has shifted, and I think he's a pretty data-driven sort, but has shifted to say that Democrats are more on the right track, pushing a populist line. But the most recent post he did suggested that while the demographics are in the Democrats' favor, while there is a embrace of more populist economics amongst the rising America electorate, that the Democratic Party, as it's constructed, is not necessarily capable of meeting that moment, and that might hamstring them and not allow them to reap the benefits of these demographic changes.
Right. Well, specifically, you know, it's an indictment of Obama's policy. You know, as he called it, the failure of the Obama administration to propel strong economic growth. And he's correct when he says the Obama years have been marked by a prolonged period of economic stagnation, falling standard of living for those in the bottom half, and growing schism in the distribution of income between top and bottom. Median family income has declined, and inequality has grown worse. These are all just true facts.
But you make a jump there, saying that all is on Obama's shoulders. Now, politically, that may be the case because of people's perceptions. But
I don't think I make the jump. I think Edsel makes the jump.
I think you're putting some words in Edsel's mouth there. I mean, there obviously is a role that Republicans have played in constricting what Obama is able to do economically here that you at least have to factor into the discussion.
Okay, well, let's take out, you know, the Republicans and go to a state where Democrats have total control, California. What have we seen in California? We are seeing, San Francisco, Palo Alto, Los Angeles, Hollywood. They're doing great. Boom times. Billions of dollars being reaped in by, mostly white, rich, educated people on the coasts. And then you go a little bit inland and you've got abject poverty. You've got the highest unemployment rate in the country in these counties. You have a humongous gap between the rich and poor that's growing faster. You have median incomes declining, throughout the state. Once you section off the super rich, wealthy parts of the Bay Area and L.A. You can't blame the Republicans there, right?
Yeah, well,
Jerry Brown got his rich person tax in. The Democrats are in total control. You can't blame the Koch brothers for controlling Sacramento.
Well, perhaps you and Nate Silver have a problem with limited time series. You know, California was hobbled for decades because of Prop 13 that drove California into the abyss over a long period. And Jerry Brown is just now getting them off of their back and putting them on some path of fiscal sanity. I mean, that process of healing is just beginning.
Are you connected to data at all? Do you know how much spending grew under Arnold Schwarzenegger? California state spending went through the roof under Democrats and, if you want to call him Republican, Arnold Schwarzenegger.
You're telling me that Prop 13 has had no impact on California's finances at all for the last 40 years.
I didn't say that. I said that the California spending has grown faster than a lot of states. Okay. I mean, has it changed the structure of how schools are funded in the state? Absolutely. But has it restrained the growth of government spending in the state? Not at all. There's no evidence of that. Just look at how much
I'll leave it to others to look up the full range of numbers on that. But this is where I think you have some myopia here. Usually the picture is a lot bigger than just what one person did by themselves over a 2-3 year window. There's other parties, there's past policies that are involved here, and what that one person did relative to where things were when he came in and what he had the leeway to do is relevant to having a true understanding of the person's record. Now, it may be that, as Edsel says, that the limitation that the depth of economic distress when Obama came in, and the inability of Republicans to meet Obama halfway on a lot of things, doesn't win Democrats any points in the minds of voters after a certain point. I think it won Obama enough points to win re-election. Perhaps it's not enough to give Democrats, you know, a hammerlock on the electoral map for a generation, and it remains to be seen. But you and I, Con, being data-driven people, I would think that we could acknowledge that it's not like Obama got his way on everything that he wanted to do. He has plenty of budgets that would have had far more robust infrastructure investment, education investment.
So what do you progressives want? Complete the control of government for how many years? I mean, the Republican hasn't won a statewide office in California for over a decade, Nate. How many decades of total Democratic control over the federal government do you want before we can say this isn't working?
I don't have a hard number for you, Con, but I would argue that in the time that Democrats have had complete control of California, they are much, 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 much better off than they were, you know, 4 years ago when people said California is dead, that its growth is stopped, that they're a fiscal basket case. Most people say California is having a comeback right now.
Well, I just said, if you live in San Francisco and Palo Alto and Beverly Hills, California is doing great right now. You know, and same with the rest of the country, right?
Are we going to hold Ronald Reagan to the standard? Did Ronald Reagan have some sort of like all boats lifted moment where poverty didn't exist? Just because you didn't like solve every last problem in a short window, that means all of your policies are bunk?
I'm just echoing Edsel's critique, which is that, for a party and a presidency that supposedly is focusing on income inequality and delivering for all Americans, they're clearly failing. Right? I mean, that's Edsel's point.
Okay, so when George Bush and the Republicans controlled Congress for how long? How long did they have total control? Was it 4 years, 5 years, 6 years?
Hey, I'm not here to defend George Bush.
All right,
we can talk about how much he expanded.
Right, because George Bush was a crypto socialist. I've heard the last time we talked, Bush is a socialist. So Reagan, Republicans had effective control for how long? Because you had a lot of conservative Democrats that gave Republicans effective control of the House. How much time did they have? Was poverty gone at the end of all that?
If you want to put Reagan's economic record up against Obama's, I am totally for that.
I'm sorry. Your point of California was that it's bad that only these wealthy areas did well, whereas other poor communities were left behind. Are you telling me that is not what happened under Ronald Reagan, Republican-controlled Washington?
I am totally. You want to put up median incomes under Ronald Reagan versus
no, no,
Obama?
No. Median incomes are not the same thing. How did East LA do? How did poor African American Latino areas do under Reagan when Republicans had full control?
Much better than they're doing under Obama.
Okay,
it's just true.
Let's compare
the Obama and Reagan recoveries.
Obama came in under one of the biggest economic crashes of global history. You have to gauge things relative to that.
Okay, we're obviously not going to agree here. So let me ask you this. Do you take anything away from Edsel's critique? Do you have any type of second givings, problems? What's your takeaway from Edsel's argument there?
My own takeaway is that I think there's two ways you can look at it. I think you can say Democrats are bogged down by a Wall Street friendly, corporate friendly wing that doesn't jibe with the more populist wing represented by Elizabeth Warren.
I think it's interesting that you say that because you're the king of corporate Democrats.
I'm not saying this is my view. I'm saying this is a view one can have. And therefore they're having they don't have a as clear and consistent economic policy. You know, the messages are mixed between, you know, robust infrastructure investment and deficit reduction, between trying to bust up the big banks and trying to regulate the big banks, all that kind of stuff. I think a lot of people on the left are going to have that takeaway. It's not my personal takeaway. I think the Democrats are the one big tent party. Republicans are ceasing to be a big tent party. I think it is inevitable that there is going to be a degree of debate between these different schools of thought that you can't wish away. There's, as I've said to you and others, Kyle, there's always going to be a degree of corporate influence. You can't vanquish that, and you have to work through those debates and try to marry those viewpoints, even though it is, even though there are tensions, even though it is frustrating. And I think Democrats have done a pretty good job navigating those waters. I think they've done a good job. I think the Recovery Act is a reflection of that. It was backed by the AFL-CIO and the Chamber of Commerce. It did get us off of our back. It did prevent a global depression. I wish Republicans were more amenable to things like an infrastructure bank, which again, both AFL-CIO and Chamber of Commerce is for. I think if they were doing more things like that now, the economy would be in a better place than it is now. I don't think those things are anathema to conservative principles. And so I think if they were being less partisan, they would be able to meet folks halfway there. So I think that is the bigger obstacle here. I don't think Democrats are going to be in... I don't think it's practical. I don't think it's feasible to shrink the party. I mean, there are certain issues where... it does not make sense to listen to the third way types. You know, there's no need to gut Social Security, for example. There's really no great benefit politically in doing that. You sort of have to go softer on Wall Street than Dodd-Frank.
So if I can stop you, here's what I'm hearing, is that Obama is doing a great job balancing the populist and corporatist wings of the party. We just need to give his corporatist agenda more time. Republicans will eventually get over their partisanship, become corporatists again, and get on board. And once they do that, then we'll all sail off into a happy corporatist future where median incomes eventually will start rising again, and unemployment will go down, and everything will be nice and happy.
Well, I'm not sure Republicans have stopped being corporatists. I think they have plenty of policies. Chamber of Commerce has now gone all in on Republicans again. They're still pushing giant tax cuts to the wealthy. They still want massive deregulation for corporations. So I don't think Republicans have separated themselves from the corporate agenda. I think that my hope is that if Democrats win again in 2016, that would be three losses in a row in presidential years. History suggests going 0-for-3 does force parties to go through big rethinks. Democrats made some big changes after Carter, Mondale, Dukakis. Clinton did some ideological recalibration there that, even though I didn't agree with all of it, I think in the big picture put the Democrats on stronger footing. I would hope that one of the things Republicans could calibrate on is to say, you know what, there's nothing anti-conservative about infrastructure. There's nothing anti-conservative about early education. There's nothing anti-conservative about having a more diverse energy mix that involves renewable energies, because we have been comfortable with plenty of energy subsidies in different areas throughout our entire existence.
There's nothing inherently
wrong with cap and trade, because we were for cap and trade with acid rain. We're not inherently opposed to all regulation and all government help. We might do it differently than Democrats, but there's overlap, historical overlap, and we can meet with Democrats halfway in these things. That's what my hope is. And I think that
so you're hoping the Republicans become Democrat Party light?
If that's what you want to call it, I don't think what I'm saying – I try not to give Republicans advice that is – go be liberals. I don't think that's a fair...
But you just did.
No, I didn't. There's nothing I have suggested that Republicans have not supported before. As a liberal, I don't say that government should do everything, because I'm not a socialist. There are things that the private market should do. I have to make a decision. What is
No, your position is just always the federal government should do more than it does now.
Not always, but often. That,
when have you ever been against the federal government doing more?
What's that?
When have you ever been against the federal government doing more?
I don't want the government to take over my supermarket. Yeah, I don't think I want government supermarkets. So, excuse me.
Give it time.
And every conservative, every Republican wants to spend taxpayer money on something. Every conservative, every Republican wants to have a government regulation on something. And if you don't want to do it on something, then you are a pure libertarian or an anarchist. And most conservatives are not those things. They pick and choose where they want their emphasis on. They're more skeptical about government than I am, but neither one of us are absolutists. And many Republicans have been Calvin Coolidge invested in infrastructure, for Pete's sake. We invested in the railroads during the Gilded Age. It's not like these, there's a general understanding that that's something that government is going to do. That's not going to be just willy-nilly done in the private market. Then you have roads and railroad tracks and airport quarters, you know, bumping into each other, you know? So I think there is way to have a meeting of the minds that does not violate basic principles here. There are plenty of Republicans that are okay with early education investments. They might disagree with Bill de Blasio how to fund it, but there's a general agreement. I mean, even Republicans that want to have charter schools and private school vouchers, you're still spending taxpayer money. It's not just being done in a libertarian way. It's still involving taxpayer funds. So there's overlap here to work with if people can put aside partisan differences.
Yeah, I think you're missing one big part, which is federalism here, which is a lot of most Republicans today want to see the state spend this money, especially on infrastructure and transportation. Absolutely on pre-K. There's no reason the federal government needs to get involved in that. Oklahoma has a very successful state pre-K program. It's working great for them. They should be able to do that. If Texas wants to do that, great. If Idaho wants to take that on, there's no, absolutely zero reason to funnel it through the federal government, Department of Education, though.
Which
the Democrats are hell-bent on doing.
Well, you know,
There's zero reason to funnel, you know, high-speed rail money through the federal government, you know, 90% of what the Democrats want to do on transportation. You know, same with energy subsidies, the rest of it. But I think we're getting bogged down here. I'll let you
go. But there are two things I've written lately on just this point. I wrote a piece for the Daily Caller. Advice from a liberal: how Republicans should be taken more seriously on poverty, and the final recommendation was: if you believe so strongly that the states should be doing the leading here, I mean, most Republican proposals on this are to take federal money and give it to the states. Now, so it's still going through the federal government, but to give to the states with basically no conditions, And my argument was, if that's your view, if you want people to take you seriously for that position, show me the Republican governor who is so interested in spending money on poverty that he or she is doing so and doing a great job doing it. I think if you had an army of governors that are willing to spend robustly on that, Democrats say, great, I'm more than happy to do this at a state level, so long as you do it. The concern is you're going to get the money and not do it. And so if you had people on the ground who are doing it, you'd have a stronger case there.
If you want to look at what Mitch Daniels did on health insurance for lower-income workers in Indiana that Mike Pence has taken over, you can look at that. If you want to look at what Texas is doing on transportation, they're looking to raise their gas tax, which I think is what a lot of Republicans are going to end up doing, because hopefully if the Tea Party Congress keeps it up, we won't raise the federal gas tax. The federal transportation dollars will dry up, and it will basically kind of de facto turn over to the states. That's the path it's on now, and I think that's great. I think Texas should want to build more highways if they want to build more highways, and if Jerry Brown wants to build a high-speed train to nowhere, he should be able to waste California's taxpayer money on that. I think that's great. But there's no reason a taxpayer in Wisconsin should have to play for Jerry Brown's, you know, train dreams.
But you'd support taking federal dollars to give it to governors, yes?
Generally, no. I mean, I would rather that the money never went to the federal government in the first place. As a second best solution, yes, if we can't get, you know, taxes lowered and let states take over these things, then okay, as a second best solution, yeah, let's go ahead and let the federal government just act as a pass through and touch the money as least as possible and give it back to the states. But ideally, we'd get other policies going on the same trajectory as transportation is.
I don't think you'd have the
gas tax slowly phase out, have federal transportation dollars slowly phase out, and let the states take over on raising their own funds, deciding what their own priorities are, and building their own infrastructure.
I don't think liberals would have that much of a problem with that if...
Great!
What?
You solved everything, Bill.
But I think the problem is if you have a large number of conservative governors who aren't just saying, look, we just think states can do this better than the Fed, so let us have leeway. If it's just that, I think liberals would generally be okay with that. But if it is, give us the authority so we can not really do it, do it half-ass, shift the money out of this account into another account.
Well, who in this model do you think should decide whether or not these Republican governors are doing it half-assed or are actually trying to do a good job? Who should decide that? Maybe the citizens and voters of those states?
Well, no, because there are things that happen at the state level that affect me too. I mean, if Texas is spewing greenhouse gases because they do all highways and all fossil fuels and nothing clean and nothing well planned, no mass transit or anything like that, it affects me. So I'm not going to just say within your borders you can do what you like because I'll get affected by it.
Global warming aside, how else does Texas affect you?
What's that?
I live in
a state of Northeast where I get tons of pollution from the Midwest. I mean, it's not a greenhouse gas issue. It's just my air that I'm breathing.
Well,
that affects me.
I'm fine with that, you know. And we have programs that have existed for decades to monitor, you know, states' pollution on each other. I'm fine with that. You know, if the EPA wants to come along and say, you know, coal plants in Pennsylvania are causing X amount of monetary damages on New Jersey. That's a great role for the federal government. Let's limit the EPA to just that. I would be totally for that. But that's not what you're talking about, right? That's not what Obama's universal pre-K is. That's not what his infrastructure bank is. That's not what any of his agenda is. His agenda is totally expanding the federal role of the government to tell Texas and the rest of the states exactly how to run everything.
Well, again, I'm not ideologically anathema to a larger federal role. I'm just saying if you really want a reduced federal role, I think you would actually get more Democratic support if you had more Republican governors who were actually doing it in a serious and responsible way and didn't just seem like a ruse to not really do it. If you had more hard evidence of people really doing it, I think you'd have an easier argument to make.
I think the hard evidence that the Republicans are doing well is just how fast Texas is growing, how many Californians are moving to Texas. And middle-class Californians, too. How many, you know, middle-class people from the upper, from, you know, the Northeast, from your air neck of the woods, are moving down to Republican states in Tennessee and Arizona, etc. You know, the proof is where people put their feet, and they're not staying in Democratic-run states.
That's, I think, probably overstating the case. But one other point I want to make here as far as relationship with the states, you have a situation now where Washington conservatives, like Grover Norquist, like the Koch brothers and their organizations, are going into Republican-run states, namely Tennessee and Ohio. In Tennessee, you have an issue where some conservatives there want to repeal their investment income tax. Tennessee already does not have any state income tax at all, so their investment tax is one of their big sources of revenue. And the Republican governor said, look, we're a very low-tax state as it is. We have a revenue shortfall right now. This is really not a good time to be repealing a tax. I can't actually make the numbers work here, people. Get off my back. And the Kochs and Norquist are trying to shame the Republican governor into accepting this repeal. In Ohio, you have Kasich, Republican governor, who has tried to do a tax reform where he would cut the state income tax, but increase taxes on other things like tobacco and natural gas drilling. I think it'd be roughly revenue neutral. He's saying it's a pro-growth reform, Kasich is. And Norquist people are beating up Kasich, saying that you shouldn't be raising taxes on anybody anywhere. Why do these Washington conservatives feel it's appropriate to interfere with, I mean, you say that who should decide these things? It should be within the borders, the voters of those states and those governors, those legislatures. Yet Washington conservatives don't leave these states alone when they don't do exactly what they want them to do. They go in there and try to impose their views. Why shouldn't, and this is why I think conservatives who want state-led policies get into trouble, because it seems like you don't actually believe that the state should have the leeway. You just want to shift the responsibility because you think it's going to get your ideological goals achieved in a backdoor way, not that you think there'll be better policies at the state level.
So what's your question?
My question is, do you think the Kochs and Norquist are wrong to meddle in what Tennessee and Ohio are doing?
They're private actors. If
what's
Norquist
good, what's
wants,
good for what's good
Norquist,
for conservatism?
If Grover Norquist wants to go to Tennessee and argue for a certain amount of tax cuts, he's a private citizen. He's totally allowed to do that. And Tennessee voters can either say, "Yeah, Grover, you're right. Your policies are great. We love you. We'll vote for your guy." Boom, done. Or they'll reject it, which is totally different than passing some new national tax at the federal level and forcing it down the Tennessee voters' throats, where they have no choice.
I understand they're not government regulators or federal politicians. I understand that.
Oh, good. Then you understand the distinction.
Is it good for conservatism, for leading conservatives to try to supersede and second guess what governors have to do at the end of the day to balance their budgets? Does it make conservatism seem like
good,
a serious ideology?
Is it good
ideology?
That a party has internal policy debates? Is that your question?
I'm asking a different question, which is, if conservatives want so badly for states to take the lead in many of these areas, and when certain governors try to do that in perhaps a not particularly ideological way, does it make conservatives look good for Washington conservatives to go in there and try to second guess that? Can you try to answer that direct question, please?
Policy debates are healthy in any party, yes.
Would you think it is would it be good for conservatism to have a governor who says, you know what, at this level, a governor has to make the numbers add up, and that involves having this level of tax, maybe sometimes a tax increase on certain constituencies, in order for this government, this state-run government, to function properly?
Absolutely. I had a column titled "Raise the Gas Tax." In Texas, you know, absolutely. If states are going to take over more of these areas, like transportation, they're sometimes going to have to raise revenues to do it, and they should be able to address how they do it. I'm totally fine with governors, state legislatures, whoever, identifying ways to match their spending and revenues. And the more we do it on a state-by-state basis, that's great. Conservatism is winning.
All right. One thing I know you wanted to talk before we wrap this up. You are intrigued by this by the different Harry Reid stories that are out there.
Yes, especially, you know, we've got this Democrats running on corporatism, and Harry Reid has diarrhea of the mouth when it comes to Koch brothers. I mean, I know you want to talk about how wonderful everything is. Foreign policy-wise, bipartisanship with Ukraine, and yet here you have Harry Reid on the floor of the Senate blaming the Koch brothers for not wanting to help Ukraine. What kind of crazy partisanship is that?
Well, I wasn't planning to get into the whole bipartisan thing today, but I'm happy to discuss it if you like. I mean, I have a piece. I don't know if it's going to get published today or not, but I wrote a piece for the week. About that the Ukraine might be representing a new era of bipartisanship foreign policy. But I mentioned in that piece that, you know, the rhetoric around it is very hot right now. You have McCain calling the Obama administration timid, having MIA on leadership. You have Harry Reid blaming Republicans for holding up the bill and possibly giving Putin the green light to annex Crimea. So, yes, that's most certainly.
So what do you think about Harry Reid's rhetoric there?
I think it is largely meaningless because at the end of the day, the bill is passing. At the end of the day, Reid accepted the Republican demand.
But there was an what was the underlying policy dispute? There was an underlying policy dispute, no?
Yeah, the policy dispute was, should this IMF reform be attached to this bill? And Reid has now stood down on that point, taken it out of the bill. The bill is going to pass most likely. And the bill is essentially going to buttress and reinforce President Obama's approach to Ukraine, which, you know, Republicans are often accused of sabotaging the president in all sorts of areas. Here is a situation where they're not sabotaging him at the end of the day.
Right. I think the story here is that, you know, almost immediately the House passed a clean Ukraine aid bill. And then the White House decided that this was a great opportunity to play politics. So they attached they told the Senate to attach the IMF funding to the bill, and Reid tried to do it. And then when conservatives like Mike Lee and Ted Cruz said, you know, look, guys, this is a straight up bipartisan Ukraine policy issue. Let's not bring your ideological baggage into this. And then Harry Reid, you know, when they did that, Harry went apeshit on the floor and blamed the Kochs for encouraging Putin to invade Ukraine, which is just totally crass. And everyone called them out on it. And thankfully, the White House realized they made a terrible error trying to politicize this. They backed down, and so did the Senate Democrats. And we were able to have a nice bipartisan Ukraine bill. It was a win.
I would characterize it a little differently. I think the White House argument and the Democratic argument was that the IMF reform was going to be very useful to Ukraine, and therefore was relevant to it. It wasn't just a chance to slap it on and piggyback. But Kerry,
it was a long-standing policy goal, yes, that they, yes, had failed to pass before. Right.
Yes, okay. I agree with that. But in testimony, John Kerry said to, I believe it was in House testimony, he said, if this is before Reid made the decision to take it out, he said, if we have to choose one or the other, we got to do the aid. And that, I think, got the ball rolling to take it out. Now, I think we're in a situation where this with both parties that there is not – you have a situation where there's very few swing districts, very few swing states, and – a lot of incentive to throw red meat at each side's base, to gin up turnout, to help with fundraising and the like. And
so what is the Koch strat? What is the Democrat strategy with constantly attaching the Kochs to appears literally everything?
I'll get that in just a second. But to the point about Ukrainians, I think you often see a situation where one a person will say something very incendiary 1 second, and then 24 hours later, do the bipartisan thing more quietly. I wrote a piece, I think a year ago, saying, you know, that there is a fair amount of bipartisanship going on, more people respect, but it's done on the sly. It's done very quietly because no one sees a lot of political benefit to be gained by doing it openly right now. But I think in the case of Ukraine here, you have a decent amount of overlap in worldview. And at the remains, we've seen whether Russia is an anomaly because people just kind of hate Russia on both sides for somewhat different reasons. Or might this actually bring about some more dialogue and might lead to some other bipartisan cooperation on foreign policy, perhaps with Iran, if that deal is not mortally threatened by what's going on in Russia right now. That remains to be seen, but I'm hopeful about that. As far as the Kochs are concerned, I think this is a fundraising strategy on the part of Reid and Democrats. I think they know that most Americans don't know who the Kochs are. And most people, I think, don't really care about these attacks on donors because they think both sides do it and it doesn't have a lot of punch to it. Your Democrats tried similar strategy in 2010. It didn't work.
Let me ask you this. Do you think when Harry Reid goes to the floor and accuses Republicans of supporting Putin invading Ukraine just to make it easier for Democrats to raise money by making the Kochs boogeymen. Does that help or undermine any type of bipartisanship on other foreign policy issues like Iran, etc.?
It's no different than John McCain going to AIPAC and saying the Obama administration is feckless and MIA and weak in the face of Putin. I don't think that helps Obama's foreign policy very well. I think it helps with a united front. I don't like either one of those things. I don't think it's good for foreign policy. I do think it's where our politics are today. And what I'm arguing is, even with all of that friction in the air that both parties seem to think is politically necessary, both of those people are not letting it get in the way of the actual legislation. And so I'm trying to put people's emphasis on the fact that, you know what, despite all of this rhetoric in the air, the actual policy being voted on, both sides are agreeing to right now. But there is a election coming up, to go back to the issue with the Kochs. I think you look at what Obama did in 2012 with Citizens United, where Democrats were freaking out about Citizens United. They're buying our democracy. The corporations are taking over. This whole thing's rigged. And they use that concern to raise a lot of small dollar money and actually outspend Romney and at least be relatively even Steven when you factored all the outside groups, and they won the race. So I think they're using the Koch brother boogeyman to help with their fundraising right now. And it remains to see if it works. But I don't think it is an expectation that they're going to win the Senate or take over the House because voters are mad at Kochs. I think most voters don't know who the Kochs are. I think Democrats know most voters don't know who the Kochs are and are not going to know who the Kochs are. But the base knows, the base is unnerved by it, and the base might give more money to try to diminish that financial advantage.
Well, fortunately, the Republicans in the off year probably won't need any goosing, but it does help that Reid was mostly penniless when he first came to the Senate. But after being in the federal government for years, he now lives at the Ritz-Carlton and is funneling tens of thousands of campaign dollars to his family, which was just revealed this week. So we'll see where that investigation lands. But, you know, as far as the face of you know, corruption and corporatism, everything that's wrong with the federal government, you can't do much better than Harry Reid. So, you know, the more he's well, out there talking about Kochs, the better.
Well, just so people understand, so if you haven't been following it, what appears to have happened was Reid wanted to give some holiday gifts to some of his donors. His young granddaughter has a jewelry company, so he bought jewelry from the company and gave them out as gifts, which was reported on his campaign finance report. It wasn't done secretly.
How much was spent?
I think they're saying $31,000 right now. It's the last I read.
Did you see the BuzzFeed post where it showed pictures of this jewelry?
I have not seen that post.
Oh, well, you should check it out. And we'll include a link so people can see this jewelry and how much of this jewelry you'd have to buy to spend $31,000.
People can well investigate that. All I know is that it was reported, wasn't covered up. So it's not something they felt like they were, in every report I've read that it actually adheres to the law. It's not like people don't do this sort of thing as far as having gifts and giving it to donors. I mean, people have plenty of events where, you know, you give food to donors, you offer, you know,
you're not buying stuff from a family member.
I think it's usually true, and I think, and Reid now has said that I'm now going to repay the campaign.
And the other part of the story you're leaving off here is that he left off her last name, so it did not appear to Reid in the reporting.
It's like you couldn't figure it out. Obviously, I really don't think they thought they were slipping one by. I mean, people who follow Reid know his family members, obviously. I mean, if they wanted to be more duplicitous about it, they could have had a front company's name, had some other person be listed as the owner, and you would never know, you know. But they have her basically her name there. Obviously, people are going to put two and two together. So I don't think it was done with the intent to deceive. If people want to try to make this into a big scandal, they can go ahead and try. I don't fault reporters for investigating it and highlighting it. But Reid saying, here's what I did. I thought people would like having a gift made by a family member. If people think it's inappropriate, I will repay the money. Voters can decide whether that is some sort of massive scandal or not. Come 2016 when he's up for re-election. I really think this is pretty small-time stuff compared to other things that are actual law violations other politicians have done in the course of things.
Right. All I'm saying is that it's catnip for the Republican base, just like the Cokes are. And not that the Republicans needed it, but you know, since we're talking about silliness of attacking the Cokes, it's in that vein.
Well, yeah. I mean, to that point, I mean, look, we all know that Republicans have a favorable field for the Senate for 2016. You have Democratic seats up in right leaning areas by the quirk of the Senate calendar, and I would think those races are going to be run on a state by state basis. You know, I don't think they're hurting for funding. I mean, the Koch thing is to help funding because a lot of Democrats are not keyed into these races, and they need to get their national base to pony up if the state bases are not strong enough. For example, in Arkansas, there's not much of a Democratic operation right there right now because Obama was never competitive there. They don't have a campaign staff or an infrastructure or small donor base, so you got to fundraise outside to buttress that. I don't think Republicans have that issue right now. So I appreciate wanting to make hay about Reid and try to gum up his narrative and soften over 2016. Obviously, that's your right. I wouldn't think that had that much impact on 2014 for Republicans.
Fair enough. We're up in an hour here. I think it's a good place to end it, Bill.
All right. Well, always going to talk to you, Con. It's nice to have you back.
Anytime.
And we'll see you next week here at the DMZ.